Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. Ahlan wa sahlan, how's it and welcome. Yeah. Yes, sis, it's been ages since I spoke to you. Did you miss me? Huh? Hello? Is there anyone out there? Okay, never mind. You know, I really missed you all very much. I had tears in my eyes. Yeah, tears in my eyes as I thought about you while I was hang gliding, swimming with dolphins, windsurfing, dining at the buffet of 1,000 dishes, snorkeling, quad biking, horse riding, or just chilling on the beach, working on my tan. Dark brown metallic color. Like they used to make the 1989 Mercedes 350 SL. But more like the the Amzimkulu River at my hometown of Port Shepson when it was in flood. Yes, people, I really miss you. But Zanzibar is really magical. And as I told you last year, if you remember, but the country still fascinates me. My group was so relaxed, completely chilled, and that's because we are far away from the two things that occupy our minds. Two things that consume us, consumes our thinking every day. Then the two things that lurk at every corner that could possibly do serious damage to us or ultimately kill us. Crime and COVID. Yeah. Those are the two things that are the main talking points here in sunny SA. There, virtually no crime and no mask at all. Seriously. Alhamdulillah. Well, I told you this before, that in the main city that's bustling and exciting and vibrant, which is Stone Town, while the group was passing through the streets teeming with people and our masks were stuck very tightly to our faces, people were laughing and saying, Hakuna Matata, no COVID in Zanzibar, no COVID in Zanzibar. Well, after the second day, we felt like first-class mamparas and we removed our masks and only wore them again when we got on the plane to come back home. Zanzibar is, as I told you before, a predominantly Muslim country, about 97%, I would say. And you see men with kurtas and big hats like way back in the 50s, and most women were wearing abayas and some with niqab. And when you stand there in the middle of Stone Town, or anywhere in Stone Town, you feel that you are in Overport because you can hear the azan from every direction. And as we drive from our Stone Town hotel to the amazing five-star beach resort, We were on the road, like here in KZN, when you drive from Phoenix to Stanger on the old road through Verulam and Tongat and so on. Lush green vegetation, and this is it. Young girls, hundreds of them walking home from school, all wearing burqas. What an absolutely, absolutely heartwarming sight, eh? And the people, humble, cheerful, and living very basic lives. Basic, like for example, you get a good job at the five-star hotel and you would be earning about $100 a month. But they seem so content, ever smiling and welcoming. And the five-star beach resort, very hard to describe that. A very huge estate, massive, with hundreds of villas dotted all over. And the beach, no words, Habibi. Durban must go and sleep. In fact, I thought about all the Joe Burgers who came down, was it last week, I think, and waited for tankers to pump Harpic into the sea. shame, man. And the chowing day at the five-star resort was non-stop. We were only allowed 23 kgs luggage on the plane, but I'm sure that our guys piling up the plates with masses of food, no doubt they must have been overweight. Yes, just one more thing. It happened again this year, same thing as last year. There I was walking on the beach and I came across one of the bullies in my group. His wife was holding his hand as she was busy speaking to a guy selling sunglasses and hats and so on. The mother was looking at the sky very intently. Well, I also looked up to see what he was concentrating on. Was it a bird? Was it a plane? Was it Superman? Well, I couldn't say anything at all. And I asked him what he was looking at, and he turned to me and whispered, "Don't lower your gaze, my brother." I thought, which pocket he took out this zigzag fatwa from. And then I accidentally looked down and was shocked. They lying on the sand all over the place where, shall I say, people of the female variety from Russia and from all parts of Europe, etc., who, let me put it this way. They were not in hijab. That's the best way I can put it. I was so disgusted that I quickly fled from the beach, never to return. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. just too much to speak about, Habibi. Come join me on the next tour. One departing on the 19th of December, inshallah, and the second one on the 26th of December. Zanzibar is experiencing a tourist boom. So for each of the two tours, I was struggling to get room. They were very, very expensive. They were. Finally, I managed to get something at a reasonable price. And I only got 20 rooms. So hurry, send an email to abie@iafrica.com. abie@iafrica.com. Or call or WhatsApp me on 082-352-3526. Don't delay. You know, last trip, October, I left 23 people behind. Or maybe if you don't work fast enough, you will come back to Durban and you must carry a big 5-liter bottle of toilet duck. Okay? but let's leave Zanzibar and get into some weightier matters, eh? But first, let me announce a disclaimer. Dear listeners, the views and opinions expressed by this presenter are entirely his own, and you may consider them to be interesting or educational or thought-provoking or confused or downright silly or nonsensical or infuriating or irrational or illogical or, what's that word? Asinine. Well, sorry, Habibi. There is nothing you can do about it. Just take it or lump it, okay? Right. But anyways, on a very somber note here, quick word. Very, very good friend of mine. I just got a message. You know, it's very difficult to open the WhatsApp these days because you get some very, very sad messages of somebody who has departed. Well, my dear friend is in ICU at the moment, extremely ill. His name is Iqbal Isup. He's at Gateway Hospital in ICU. Please make dua for him. Iqbal Isup. Right, let's start. The hot story this week was about the two cabinet ministers and a deputy minister. And they were told that they were being held hostage at a hotel in Pretoria by a group known as the Liberation Struggle War Veterans. Meaning the ANC militants and also the others who fought like they are Mkhonto we Sizwe, and there was APLA and others also. They were demanding 4.2 million rands each, plus housing allowance, plus medical aid for their families and bursaries for the children to study at university and so on. Apparently they've been asking this for some time, and the people in the government or the ANC or whoever it was responsible for taking their concerns were turning a deaf ear. So, well, as the cabinet ministers were about to leave, the veterans closed the doors. Then the tamasha started. Tanadan, fireworks. A special police tactical unit went in and sorted them out. 54 were arrested and a number were injured, and they faced charges of kidnapping. But let me pause for a moment and say this. You know, I really don't know how these things work. I was always of the view that when you see your people being oppressed, then you want to fight this oppression as a personal matter. You are angry, you want justice and equal rights and so on. Happens in all parts of the world. You are motivated to free your people. No one says that you must do it. But you are driven. You decide totally by yourself, driven by your conscience. I suppose you got my drift, ne? You are motivated. You don't want to be paid to do the right thing. Your reward is to see that your people are free. Khalas, that's it. But they want 4.2 million each. Now, as I said, I don't know the validity of all of that. I just gave you my thought. Well, if you say that yes, they should be paid, then what about the hundreds of thousands who also took part in helping to liberate this country? Remember June 76? They poured out of the schools and said no to Afrikaans and no to apartheid. The world was shocked. Shouldn't they also be paid for doing the very same thing and to pressure the government, the apartheid government? And what about all the UDF guys, the United Democratic Front, Alan Busak, Fatima Meer, and hundreds who were locked up and tortured? I can go on and on. The question is, who actually liberated this country? Let me repeat that. Who actually liberated this country? Was it just this small group of militants? Or big group of militants? Or Apla? That, dear listeners, is a very big question. And at some point, I said that that's a big question, but it is questionable also the role of some who say that they did it. Ponder on that a bit, my dear erudite, discerning, distinguished listeners. Ponder on that. But wait. Inspiration is now rapidly entering my brain. Stop sniggering there at the back, okay? Stop sniggering. Inspiration does come into my brain now and then. You know, I think that the actions of the war veterans was totally despicable and should be strongly condemned by every right-thinking person. It was a hopeless exercise to take the two cabinet ministers as hostage. Not good at all. Not good at all. My suggestion to them is that they should go to Cape Town, and when Parliament is in full session, go in quietly and lock the doors from the inside. And then take the podium and announce loudly, all those who are infected with the Chorwan virus are now under strict quarantine. You are now all under strict quarantine. All those who have the Chorwan virus, own up, confess. Those who stole the money of the hard-working taxpayers must call their accountants now. Phone their accountants and tell them to transfer the money to SARS immediately, or you will not be allowed to leave until you are cured of the virus. VBS looters must pay back the money. Pay back the money. Pay back the money. And those who got monies for looting Transnet, 40 billion disappeared there. SAA, 26.5 million. Denel, 250 million. SABC, 62 million. Eskom, 7 billion. IDC, 250 million. And all state entities. Your lockdown will not end until the money is paid back. And Mr. Praveen Gordhan, you may leave. Go to your former office and give us a report about how the bucks are coming in. Hey? So there you are. What do you think of that idea? Eh? Locking up two cabinet ministers is such a complete waste of time. You brave war veterans liberated us once. Now please liberate us from the Chorwans. Amandla! I'm just kidding, man. Oh, yeah, I can get into trouble, yeah? I'm just kidding. Or maybe not, eh? I took a leaf out of the book of... what was that guy's name? Mohammed bin Salman, the leader in Saudi Arabia who locked up all those rich O's, remember? Rich, locked them all up and said, hey, you better pay up for all the looting that you've done. Okay, well, still on the local scene, and we go to the township of Phoenix. And, of course, this is a somewhat vexing issue. But, my dear listeners, again, I want to explain where the word Phoenix comes from. Now, you see, in ancient Greek mythology, there's a story about a very large and very colorful bird associated with the sun god, Ra. Well, to be brief, the bird, it lives for 500 years, and every now and then it builds a nest and fills it with all kinds of perfume, myrrh, and all that kind of stuff. Myrrh, M-I-R-R-A, I think that's how it's spelled. And all nice-smelling stuff. Then it sits on the nest, and it strikes its beak on the rock, which sets the, well, some sparks flying, and the nest and the bird itself are on fire, and therefore it dies. But you know what? Almost immediately, instantly, the bird comes back to life again, complete, from the ashes. From the ashes. Anyway, that's the story of this mythological bird, dear children. This is an educational program. Pay attention, okay? So I think the Phoenix, the township in the north of Durban, fits very well with the life of the bird. Just when you thought that the so-called Phoenix massacre stories died in July, in the July looting, just when you thought that that story was completely dead, well, it has risen up again from the ashes like the phoenix of mythology. Yes, folks, it's about the DA posters on light poles all over Phoenix. Let me hasten to add, so that you don't misunderstand. People are ready to misunderstand. I'm not a DA supporter. Underline that. Okay, Mamu? You got it clear? Right? So, let's rewind a little to those terrible days in July. The country was on fire. People in many suburbs set up roadblocks to prevent looters from entering. At the entrances of Phoenix, it happened in my town, my suburb of Isipingo also, where the guys manned roadblocks and so on. And at the entrance of Phoenix, some really bad guys, there were of course some good guys there also, but there were really bad guys, went too far. And allegedly, they killed over 30 innocent black people. Right? That was the report. 30 innocent black people were killed. Well, no doubt about it. No excuse. It was absolutely horrible. A crime. Murder. Nothing else. Plain thuggery. And then the media went into a feeding frenzy. Frenzy. They went crazy. The focus was no more on the dozen or so mad guys with guns who murdered innocent black people. No. The impression that was generated, that was created. Yes. The impression, and I want to tell you because I was listening very closely, the impression that was created by the media and the politicians was that the people, yes, the people, meaning all the people of all of the Indians of Phoenix, were responsible for these murders collectively. Let me say that again. The murders were terrible and should be condemned, and the perpetrators should be jailed. Finish. No excuses at all. It was scandalous. Scandalous. But in focusing disproportionately on Phoenix only, two other scandals were almost ignored. One is the fact that the government did not send out the police and military immediately to prevent looters having a free-for-all. You know that. I know that. There was such a delay. So much could have been protected and saved had it done so. The government had done so. And it had the responsibility to do so. But didn't. Didn't. Right? Not only that. Of course, that is the big question. And the big scandal that the government didn't do that. That needed to be focused on, of course, and looked into. But seems to have just faded away, the irresponsibility of the government. Secondly, it emerged clearly that the mayhem was well orchestrated. And, of course, rightly or wrongly, fingers were pointed at the Zuma supporters who allegedly called for people to go out and express their anger. Right? Coded word for anarchy. That was and is a huge scandal. But it also seems to have faded. One or two guys were, well, I think they're going to stand trial and so on. But that wasn't the main focus at that time. And so at that time, and I was listening very, very closely, as I told you, very intently to the media and the overwhelming cacophony, noise that filled the airways was Phoenix, Phoenix, Phoenix massacre, Phoenix, innocent blacks killed by Indians and so on. In fact, at a press conference, I heard Julius Malema. You know, I could be wrong, but from my memory, or at that time, I was shocked at what I heard. He said, the Indians of Phoenix are racist. He didn't say some Indians. He said, the Indians. Meaning collectively, all of them. That was such an outrageous statement. Scandalous for demonizing an entire group of an entire race, and also very, very dangerous, and therefore racist. That was a huge scandal, but nothing. Water under the bridge. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. And because of this onslaught by the media and politicians, the people of Phoenix were wilting. They were pained. They were painted with a big brush as bad people, racist. And I'm sure that they felt very dismayed, very sad and frustrating to be portrayed in this manner. Well, ta-ta-da-da, it's election time, people. It's time to get the votes. And what do politicians do? What do they do? They butter up the people. We all know that. We all know that. Hey, thick butter. Thick butter. And so the DA decided to make the people of Phoenix feel nice, feel better. You know, pat them on the head a little bit. Well, you know, politicians will exploit any issue to get the votes. So posters were put up on light poles. The ANC called you racist. The DA calls you heroes. The ANC calls you racist and the DA calls you heroes. Good heavens, who thought up that clumsy wording? Clumsy because the message was ambiguous, meaning it could be open for interpretation. And it could be interpreted in two ways. One way is to say, hey, you know what? It's not fair that all of you were condemned as being racist just because of the actions of a few thugs. And so we, the DA, think that you all are good people, brave people, heroes. Heroes? Actually, it's a very silly word to use, in my opinion. The second interpretation is that the DA is saying that the thugs who committed the acts of murder against innocent blacks are wonderful people, heroes. Now, let me pause and say this. Dear listeners, who in their right minds would ever think of saying that a murderer is a good person? I mean, really? That would be grossly stupid, insane, correct? So my view is that those who put up the posters never meant it to mean that the shooters were heroes. And so the message on the posters, as I said, was clumsy, open to interpretation. And the media and the politicians got into it, got onto the bandwagon and took the second interpretation that the DA is that the DA is complimenting the murderers. I actually heard one senior news presenter on SABC say, with a very, disturbed voice, how can the DA support the murder of innocent blacks? Oh, when I heard that, I fell off my chair. She actually said this, how can the DA support the murder of innocent blacks? And of course, politicians of other parties, as you would expect, went to town in condemning the DA. Shame, eh? Poor John Steenhuisen and Helen Ziller tried to put up some sort of defense, but they failed dismally. But the issue had hit the fan in a big way, and so they had to retreat. They had to back down and bring the posters down. Talk about backfiring in a big, spectacular way, eh, Mamu? Instead of making the ANC look like racist, the tables turned to make the DA look racist. Hey, Mota, politics in South Africa, Never a dull moment, Habibi. And the DA Phoenix branch members who thought up that silly poster must have got lots of scolding. I can just imagine, hey, where's your brains? Did you have some dope or something, eh? What do you want to say, heroes and all? You all really caused it for us, man. Hey. And there I was on the beach chilling and getting myself nicely bright, and all that tamasha was carrying on here. Ish. I just can't leave you children alone for a short while and you capsize everything, eh? Okay, so let's leave our wonderful country and move over to, well, further north and look at Africa. We seldom do that. And let's speak about Demain Sankara. That's right. Demain Sankara. Well, that's the French pronunciation. Demain Sankara. You know, it always seems that when people speak French, somebody is choking them, or they just got a big blob of phlegm stuck in their throats. My teacher in school in Chepi was testing us on some foreign words that we're supposed to learn, some foreign expressions. She used to pronounce one as "si vos plaquet." It means please, or if you please, or if you don't mind, and things like that. It is spelled S with a big nukta on top, I L, and the next word is VOS PLAIT. So she used to pronounce it "si vos plaît." Well, I don't blame her for saying it like that. No French people came to Chepi. Actually, it's pronounced s'il vous plaît. The French eat half the words, and of course we know that they eat frog legs also and funny things. So imagine going to a restaurant in Paris and wanting to show off, and you say to the waiter, if you are from Chepi and you learnt it that way, say, excuse me, old boy, can you bring me the menu, si vos plaît? Si vos plaît. He'll probably look at you when you say this and think that you're a first class, même pas ra. So, this is how you would say it. Garçon, bring me the menu, s'il vous plaît. S'il vous plaît. Garçon means waiter. Well, that's your French lesson for today. Now, close your books, children, and pay attention. How did I get to that? You people, you know, you like to distract me. Okay, so, I'll be speaking about Thomas Sankara. Actually, it's spelled Thomas Sankara. Thomas Sankara. So, we know him as Thomas Sankara. Of course, you all know who is Thomas Sankara, right? Right? You are all highly knowledgeable, well-educated, fully aware of world politics, and supremely intelligent, wagera wagera. So, yes, you do know who is Thomas Sankara. Huh? Excuse me? What was that? I beg your pardon? Did you all actually say you don't know? Hey! What is this, eh? Are you joking? No? Good heavens, I'm completely shocked. You don't know who is Thomas Sankara? I am speechless. Seriously, I really overestimated you people, thinking that you are smart and clever and know everything. I am very, very disappointed and disgusted. And the only thing I'm going to say to you, and please don't be offended, the only thing I'm going to say to you is that the truth is that I really didn't know who was Thomas Sankara until a few days ago. Yeah. Yes, I heard some time ago that I sort of knew vaguely that he was some great African leader, a visionary or something like that, and that was about it. Nothing else. You know, I generally pretend to be a know-all, but but that's it. I knew just about zero about this man. And when I looked into who he was, I was, well, as the Irish would say, gobsmacked. Gobsmacked. Gob is mouth, and gobsmacked means, of course, you catch a lucker clap over the mouth from your bully if you talk nonsense. Eh? So I was gobsmacked. What prompted me to look into his life? Well, yesterday, Friday, the 15th of October, was the anniversary of his assassination in 1987 at the age of 37. It was all over Al Jazeera and BBC and CNN and many programs about him on SAFM here in South Africa over the past few days. So I was curious and checked him out and his country, Burkina Faso, a tiny country in West Africa. People, listeners, I tell you, what an amazing guy. Listen carefully. Just to be brief, let me just quickly read to you from Wikipedia. Viewed by supporters as a charismatic and iconic figure of revolution, he is commonly referred to as Africa's Che Guevara. After being appointed Prime Minister in 1983, disputes with the sitting government led to Sankara's eventual imprisonment. While he was under house arrest, a group of revolutionaries seized power on his behalf in a popularly supported coup later that year. Age 33, Sankara became the president of the Republic of Upper Volta. He immediately launched programs for social, ecological, economic change and renamed the country from the French colonial name Upper Volta to Burkina Faso, which means land of the incorruptible people, with its people being called Burkinabe, meaning upright people. Wow. So the moment he took power, he immediately went to work to transform his country. This is what I'm saying now, right? He wanted to break away from the grip of the former colonial ruler, the colonial master, which was France. France ruled this place. And they still had influence at that point via a very rich black elite in the country who were very closely aligned to the French colonialists. He didn't want to have anything to do with the World Bank or the IMF or such loan sharks who would further enslave the country. And he believed that African countries had the resources to build themselves up with no outside help and interference. Let me tell you what this young leader achieved. And again, I want to read from Wikipedia. Fascinating stuff, Habibi. Follow this. Right, follow this. Fascinating stuff. His domestic policies were focused on preventing famine with agrarian, that is, the agriculture, self-sufficiency and land reform, prioritizing education with a nationwide literacy campaign and promoting public health by vaccinating more than 2 million children against meningitis, yellow fever and measles. Between 18,000 and 50,000 children who died annually of measles and meningitis now lived. His government focused on building schools, health centers, water reservoirs, and nearly 100 kilometers of rail with little or no external outside assistance. Total cereal production rose by 75% between 1983 and 1986. Other components of his national agenda included planting over 10 million trees to combat the growing desertification of the Sahel, redistributing land from private landowners, suspending rural poll taxes and domestic rents, and establishing a road and railway construction program. On the local level, Sankara called on every village to build a medical dispensary and had pharmacies built in 5,384 out of 7,500 villages. From 1982 to 1984, the infant mortality rate dropped from 208 per 1,000 births to 145. School attendance under Sankara increased from 6% to 22%. Moreover, he outlawed female genital mutilation, forced marriages and polygamy. He appointed women to high governmental positions and encouraged them to work outside the home and stay in school even if pregnant. As an admirer of the Cuban Revolution, Sankara set up Cuban-style committees for the defense of the revolution. And therefore, as such, he encouraged the prosecution of officials accused of corruption, counter-revolutionaries, and lazy workers. They were tried at popular revolutionary tribunals. Opposition parties and unions were also banned, and media freedoms were curtailed as striking teachers were fired. Right? So he took a very strong stand to fix up his country. Wow, eh? The country made amazing strides, listeners, and he was hugely popular amongst his people. And he was a very, very humble guy. Eh? Let me tell you how humble. He got rid of all the government's fleet of big Mercedes-Benz. And a big surprise, he used to ride a bicycle to get around, and he used to go to the center of the town, and queues of people would wait to ask him questions or voice their grievances. What a guy, hey, what a guy. Imagine, imagine if I was Cyril Bai, hey, with no bodyguards, riding a bicycle into central Joburg and stopping to speak to people. People will either fall down with shock or die laughing. Right, so why was Thomas Sankara assassinated? No one really knows the real answer. The speculation is that certain groups were not happy with him. For example, the former colonizers, and that's France and its ally Ivory Coast also for one. And then the powerful middle class that were aligned with France. The black middle class that were aligned with it. They were making maja under French rule, under colonial rule. And of course, there were the tribal leaders who were stripped of their long-held privileges of forced labor. They took people as slaves and made them work. And also, they got nice bucks, they called tribute payments. So Sankara had to go. Because he took action against all these people, there were grumblings and rumblings, and he had to go. He was only supported by a small group of military officers who were on his side, and he made all the decisions from the top, and it went down. So they had to get rid of him. And he was shot in the presidential palace on the 15th of October, 1987. So why, after 37 years, all the media are suddenly all focusing on him? Well, it's about a man called Blaise Compaoré. Blaise Compaoré was his childhood friend. They were almost like brothers, brought up in the same house, best friends. When Sankara took power, Blaise became Minister of State at the presidency. As I said, there were certain powerful groups that were not happy with Sankara because he stripped them of power and privilege. And Sankara, who was outspoken about outside interference, gave a speech at the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia on the 29th of July, very important day, 29th of July 1987, 2 months before he was assassinated. The speech was entitled, A United Front Against Debt. Debt means owing of money. It was a powerful speech in which he stated that all African countries should stop paying their former European colonial masters the billions of dollars that they had to pay, that was said that African countries owed to them. Here's part of the powerful speech. Let me see how much I can get through here. This is what he said. We think that debt has to be seen from the perspective of its origin. Debt's origin comes from colonialism's origin. Those who lend us money are those who colonized us. They are the same ones who used to manage our states and economies. These are the colonizers who indebted Africa through their brothers and cousins who were the lenders. We had no connection with the debt, therefore we cannot pay it. Debt is neocolonialism in which colonizers have transformed themselves into technical assistants. We should rather say technical assassins. They present us with financing, with financial backers, as if someone's backing could create development. We have been advised to go to these lenders. We have been offered nice financial arrangements. We have been indebted for 50, 60 and even longer years. That means we have been forced to compromise our people for over 50 years. Under its current form, controlled and dominated by imperialism, debt is a skillfully managed reconquest of Africa, intended to subjugate its growth and development through foreign rules. Thus, each one of us becomes the financial slave, which is to say a true slave of those who had been treacherous enough to put money in our countries with obligations for us to repay. We are told to repay, but it is not a moral issue. It is not about this so-called honor of repaying. Mr. President, we have been listening and applauding Norway's Prime Minister when she spoke right here. She is European, but she said that the whole debt cannot be repaid. Debt cannot be repaid first because if we don't repay, lenders will not die. That is for sure. But if we repay, we are going to die. That is also for sure. Those who led us to indebtedness gambled as if in a casino. As long as they had gains, there was no debate. But now that they suffer losses, they demand repayment. And we talk about crisis. No, Mr. President. They played, they lost. That's the rule of the game, and life goes on. We cannot repay because we don't have any means to do so. We cannot repay. We cannot pay because we are not responsible for the debt. What do you think of that? So there you are, folks. Breathtaking stuff. He gave the speech at the organizers of Africa. He said, told all Africans, don't pay all these colonial masters. And that, of course, sealed his fate. Dangerous talk. Africans must stop paying their former colonial masters. 2 months later, he was dead, killed, assassinated. And why is it in the news today? Well, as I said, his lifelong friend, Blaise Compaoré, was in the government of Sankara. He denied any involvement in the killing, saying that he was at home sick. But by the evening of that day of the assassination, he was the new president of Burkina Faso. The new regime under him gave back the privileges to all those Chorwans that that Sankara had booted out, including he gave privileges back to France and the black middle class. The clock had turned back, and it was back to Maja. Maja Compaoré he was booted out in a mass uprising in October 2014 after 30 years as president, and fled to neighboring Côte d'Ivoire. Hey, there's my French again. Côte d'Ivoire. That's the Ivory Coast. I'm just showing my French accent. Mon chéri. Yeah. Not mochery, uncle. Not mochery, mota. Mochery. It means my dear or my darling, my cherished one. Mochery. Well, you can shock the fro when you go home today and address her as mochery. She'll either get romantic or think that you're cronk, eh? Hey, but I digress. So on Monday, the trial of Compaoré and 14 others started in Burkina Faso. They were, of course, not in the country. Some of them, 12 of them, I think, were there. For carrying out the assassination of one of Africa's iconic leaders, a committed African, a son of the soil, a brave and committed man, Thomas Isidore Noël Sankara. Be sure to follow the trial, dear erudite, knowledgeable listeners. Very, very interesting. I set the whole stage for you, the whole background. Now it's for you to follow. Maybe next time we'll look at another great leader of Africa, Patrice Lumumba. Of course, all of you know him, right? Patrice Lumumba? You all know him? Hey? I'm going to leave it right there, Habibi. Ah, just one more historic point about yesterday. Yesterday, Friday the 15th, it was another anniversary. In 1993, on this day, Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk shared the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating the end of apartheid in favor of a non-racial democracy. Viva the radio, the Rainbow Nation, viva! Wow, eh? Amazing, right? And they all lived happily ever after. So the last one, the last one leaving the room, please turn the lights off. Hey, I forgot. That's Eskom's job, eh? I tell you, South Africa is a very funny place. Let me see if I got time for just one more thing. Still on the subject of Western imperialism and colonization, I am forever amazed at the double standards and plain hypocrisy of the West. They claim to have the moral high ground. But yet they pillage and plunder and support dictators and steal resources and bomb and killed. And they say that they hold the moral high ground. What a load of bullshit nonsense. Eh? Western civilization. Good heavens. Eh? Good heavens. Yeah, I was going to play you a little clip, but I see I'm rapidly running out of time on the subject of the so-called civilized West, but perhaps we shall leave it for next week, inshallah. It was already... Sister Anissa Isak did a great job of putting the clip together. So we'll leave that for next week. And let's go to the light at the end of the tunnel. Ronnie is sprawled out on the lounge suite, watching soccer. All sprawled out like a lazy lump. Pushpa is just about to leave, and she says to Ronnie, "Ron, I'm going to Checkers. You want anything?" And Ronnie replies, "I want a sense of meaning and purpose in my life. I seek fulfillment and completeness to my soul. I want to discover the spiritual side of me." And Pushpa says, "Hey, be more specific, eh? You want Carling Black Label or Castle Lager?" this is Amy Dawji bidding you all assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.